previously.tv podcast network.
Mother, you guys, I happen to think that I'm good at my job, but there's only so much I can do, and especially when I am swamped, sick, and underpaid.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Beverly Hills 90210. Today's episode is Season 8, Episode 25, and this is the title, Aunt Bee's Pickles. And now here are your hosts, Tari Ariano and Sarah D. Bunting.
Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Tara and Dave.
A couple of things before we actually get into this episode. I don't know what this title is a reference to, and it enraged me so much I refuse to look it up. I think there's an Aunt Bee on the Andy Griffith Show, but I never watched that because I'm not that old. I am very old, but not that old. So if anyone has a guess as to why this episode is called that, please tell us on the forums at previously.tv because, I mean, it's idiotic either way, but at least there has to be some kind of reason. And this is, it's even worse than like the elephant father or whatever that one was a few episodes ago.
No one will admit to Aunt Bee's homemade pickles being the worst they've ever tasted. Andy switches them with store-bought ones to avoid eating hers. The Pickle Story, 1961, Andy Griffith Show.
Okay.
I still don't get what that has to do with this episode.
Is there somebody who has something terrible going on about them?
Donna.
I mean, I guess it's Donna's dresses. Donna's dresses are Aunt Bee's pickles.
See? But we'll, the modern we'll metaphor of which there
All
are
right,
no
problem
equals.
Solved. And one more thing before we get into it, just a reminder, you can buy an ad on this podcast, $100 for a commercial message, $50 for a personal message. We will not screw it up like I just did with this throw. Go to previously.tv/ads for more information. And now, because we can't put it off any longer, our D plot, shut up, Steve, shut up, Jill, and shut up, Ted. For real, though.
This is still going on, and it's not going to be done for another episode.
Yes. This is not the end. This is episode 3 of 4 of the Jill and Ted saga. I mean, it's not okay.
No,
but
it's not.
But we have to get through it. So Steve has actually found Ted. He is on the front page of his company's newsletter, and Steve apparently thinks he is cute and pessimistically whines that Ted and Jill are probably soulmates. So he goes to Jill's hotel room to give her the address to Ted's office. She is not at all moved by his compliments of her letters. And when he asks her, doesn't she ever wonder why Ted never came looking for her? Like, maybe because he wasn't getting her letters. That's the whole reason the storyline started. Like, we don't know how long the correspondence had been going on before Ted moved. But, like, this makes no sense, Steve.
No. I mean, like, it's... I don't know what he's trying to accomplish. Like, surely he knows that that's the case. So
yes.
I don't know what he's trying to put in her head.
Right. It becomes slightly more clear when she demands Ted's contact info and Steve basically says he's not going to give it to her unless she goes out with him. And instead of being grossed out, she is charmed. Like, Jill, you are part of the problem. So, then Janet gives Steve the parking ticket that she got while she was double parked, picking up his dry cleaning the night before because he had told her he needed it for a meeting that night. But the meeting is a date with Jill because Steve is very unprofessional and abusive of the people who work for him, as we already knew. And the date is a disaster, ending with a flat tire. Jill is somehow still charmed, but also still in love with Ted. And Steve finally gives up Ted's info, but she does not even write it down. And he sort of hopefully says, if it doesn't feel right, then she doesn't have to meet Ted. But instead, she orders Steve to set up a meeting between them so that she and Ted meet that way. Like, why? Okay. Like, again, Jill, you're part of the problem. Stop involving Steve. So then a guy named Donald, who we will get to in the A plot, shows up at the beat to interview for an editor job. But Steve hires him in the meantime to come to the restaurant and pose as Ted, or what he says is going to be a financial expose. And at the restaurant, Jill wants to know how she and Ted are going to recognize each other. And since A, Donald is there being fake Ted, and B, Steve hasn't told her that he knows what Ted really looks like from the newsletter, he takes off to make a phone call, but instead pulls this Donald guy aside to tell him the real situation, and also that the real Ted is there being cute and getting flirted with by ladies at the bar. And since there is a labor story in our A-plot, I'll just say here that when I Google image search this guy to get his name, one of the results was a quote by him saying that raising the minimum wage is bad for working people in Michigan because of reasons. Like, it was very vague and weird, and no, it's not Tim Allen. But anyway, Donald may look like a nebbish, but he is dropping some truth on Steve in clip two.
But the thing of it is, she's never met him in person. She's only read his letters.
That is true love.
Ah, is it? Because if she met someone who she thought wrote those letters, someone, let's say, with a little less assuming presence, someone
who looked like me,
would she still want him?
So it's a test.
Yes, yes, it's a test, a love test, a test of true love.
But you're changing all the variables, not just looks. It's not a fair test. You love this girl? You want her to be happy?
Yeah.
Even if it makes you miserable? Because that's the test of true love.
You're right.
Is he though? Oh, that's right. Who cares?
Who cares? Literally no one. So Steve brings Jill over to the bar to introduce her to Ted, and they both ignore him and get lost in each other's eyes. But then later, Jill shows up at the Walsh house to thank Steve. He thinks that she's coming to say goodbye to him forever, but it turns out she spent all of her time with Ted talking about how great Steve is. Steve was right all along. They are meant to be together. Why were we put through this? Why? So dumb.
I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, I do know, but I also don't know. Like, why is there all this stalling before, like, the end of the season plot lines? Just make the seasons shorter.
Please. Honestly.
Please.
But as we said, there is still somehow going to be more Jill in the next episode. Moving on to the C-plot. Noah planned to buy Donna success, not go too well. Oh, Noah. When Donna brings one of her own dresses as a gift for Val's birthday, which we will get to, Kelly is a bitch about it in clip three.
Oh, a Donna Martin original. How exceptionally giving of you.
Call me a sucker on birthdays.
We'll be on the racks tomorrow at Miley's.
Oh, I love that store.
You guys are in business. Congratulations.
Thanks. So, you finished the whole order?
Oh, only 20.
I thought the store said they didn't need them until Friday.
Yeah, but they said if I got dinner early, I could just take him over there.
Donna, you were in the emergency room last week.
What? So she's left her overdose. She's started counseling. In that time, she's had made herself 20 dresses in like less than a week ahead of deadline. Why does the timeline on the show still have to be this dumb? When they no longer have, like, the school year to fence them in terms of, like, when stuff happens. It's so stupid.
I just don't. And also, like, she's a designer, not a seamstress. Like, we've never seen her sewing.
No, never.
I so doubt that she could do, like, even the Project Runway kids. Mm-hmm. All right, whatever, kids. Some of them are our age. But they have, like, to do a mini collection that is half that many, they have, like, months.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, so after the credits, Donna is in the store loitering around her dresses when Noah comes in to mildly tease her. And we find out she's been in there all day and she's excited to tell Noah about the one dress that they've already sold until she sees the buyer returning it and goes over to harass her without identifying herself. And it turns out that the buyer is returning it because she mistakenly thought it was a Donna Karen.
Also in this scene, and you will see this in our visual aids, in addition to the usual cleavern that she's totally unprofessionally accessorizing with.
Yep.
She is wearing a Barney purple, like twin set cardigan. a very pale, like, stripper lavender cami that is showing off the cleavern and looks like this is a horrible color mm-hmm. on her in her mm-hmm. current state of orangeness.
Yep.
And then Barney purple platform pumps. Mm-hmm. It's horrendous.
Yeah. I mean, it's very of the time, which is unfortunate, but yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Not your purple girl.
Mm-mm. So the next morning, Noah wakes Donna up to tell her that Sally, the Maya Lee buyer, is on the phone for her. And clip four.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
A brief heeing, but it still counts. So it turns out all of Donna's dresses sold. She will need 2 weeks to make more. And she wants to pay Noah back all the money he gave her. And he's like, no rush. And then she says maybe they could take me even more of his money and open a store. And he's like, hold up. And tells her that even if her dresses hadn't sold, she would still be just as talented. And she can't believe he has this much faith in her, like enough to not give her more money, I guess. But whatever. She gives him a Barbie hand hug and a simper, as you can see in the visual aids, of course. And so Noah then comes home to the boat later to find Donna there with champagne, but the making out doesn't last long before she's noticing mail from Maya Lee and opening it, and she says it's a check for the dresses, which she says is a mistake because they already paid her, and he says he'll deal with it, and she reminds him that he had told her it was cash on delivery. Now, I don't get this. Like, why would Maya Lee send him a check? Wouldn't they be sending him an invoice? Because as we know, he bought them.
Yeah.
I mean, unless it's that Donna doesn't know the difference between a check and an invoice, but I just figured like they didn't care and just like, well, it looks suspicious, but whatever.
Also,
it makes no sense.
Don't open other people's mail. I'm sorry. Like, yeah. I don't open Dan's mail, even if it's like junk mail from SAG, which he gets a lot of. Hey, guys. hey, Gabrielle Carteris, can you put a stop to that shit? Because it's killing trees. Like, we are married.
Yeah.
It's like, it's my health insurance, too. I'm still not opening it. It's addressed to him.
Right.
Never. Maybe I'm just too trusting. Maybe he's, like, buying a bunch of proofreading jobs that I bit. I don't know. There is no analog because this is really stupid.
It is.
But they can't, like, mid-conversation, that, like, when Noah is lying about it, there's, like...
Right.
Some point at which he's like, well, but it's usually on commission. And it's like, well, that's not how that works either per your previous sentence. But okay. Like
right.
The thing is, who cares? Not the writers.
Yeah. Right. He looks all guilty and crestfallen. He says it was always his money because the store bought the dresses on consignment. So but it still doesn't make sense. He has a friend in corporate. He says after the OD and getting fired, he wanted to help Donna believe in herself, but now she knows he doesn't. And then she's mad. And then later finds him at the club to essentially say that she's sorry she got mad. She knows he was trying to protect her and says her faith in men has been tested this year. Like, yeah, by the one who sexually assaulted her friend, for example, that you're still seeing. That doesn't come up. And then she goes up to Noah's office to show him some sketches and he tries to get rid of her, but he's too slow. And she sees all of the Donna Martin originals he bought, like just sitting there out. You know, I get that he might not have a closet in his office, but like put him in garment bags at least, or like put him in your car, like do better.
Or
this is like you wanted to get fired. God.
Garbage.
Or put him in the garbage.
That's where they belong. Like just walk out into the mall next to the fountain where people throw the pennies, stuff them into the garbage.
Take them straight to Goodwill. You know, she's not going to shop there. I mean, not that the poor deserve those either. Anyways, now she's all mad again. So they end up making an agreement. The next time they have a problem, she won't go for the medicine cabinet if he won't go for his wallet. And then somehow the head buyer for Burnett's department store wants to buy 100 of her dresses. There's another heeing. That's the end. So stupid.
Uh-huh.
Okay, on to our B plot. Val and Kelly try to...
There's just not a lot to say. Like...
No.
Nobody involved cares. Literally nobody.
True. On to the B plot. Val and Kelly try to reverse parent trap their parents. So it's Val's birthday. David arranged a surprise birthday party for Val. Kelly is a bitch about it. No one even has presents, apparently, except like the only thing that qualifies is the dress that Donna brings over. And there's a surprise fail when Bill and Abby show up, and Abby makes a crack about Val being a late riser, and Bill's like, just like her mother, and gross. And also, Abby has a huge surprise for Val, which we all know what it's going to be. Outside on the doorstep, Val tells David she's glad they can be alone now, and she's not psyched to see all her friends there to surprise her, plus Kelly and Donna and Noah and her mom. David really sucks at parties, I guess, is what we're learning from this guest list. And then Abby totally upstages the birthday girl by announcing that she and Bill are engaged, and this happens, clip 5.
Well, you guys will be sisters now.
It's the only thing keeping me alive some days, you guys. Just let me have it. Just let me have this.
Yeah. Oh, I also don't know why the, like, funky gospel organ is the soundtrack of this storyline, but it is. That's not the last time we're going to hear it.
No, it's not.
Ugh. So the next day, Val is bitching about the engagement when David gives her his gift. Her mom used to give her a charm for her charm bracelet every year, she says. She hated it, but she's never been able to get rid of it. And David's gift is a heart charm for that very same charm bracelet. And she kind of doesn't really even try to act like she likes it, which is amusing. She's like, well, it's a thought that counts. In other words, this sucks. Then Kelly and Val meet at the Peach Pit, where Kelly notices that each of their parents gave them matching necklaces. This meeting is to strategize about dividing and conquering, as we hear in clip 6.
Okay, I'm going to talk to your dad, but my mom is completely deaf to me. Luckily, she's going to be eager to please you.
Me?
Yeah, hit her low, hit her really hard with the truth about your dad.
Well, when you say it like that, it makes me want to defend him.
Look, this is no time for family pride or loyalty. I mean, do you want to be sharing holidays and birthdays and matching outfits with me for the rest of your life?
Preach.
She does not.
Sister Malone.
Yes. So when we see Val next, she's warning Bill that the only money Abby has is from the sale of the house. He claims he doesn't want her money. He knows he was a shitty husband and father, but now he appreciates what it is to come home to someone. She tells him to find another sucker and that neither she nor Kelly approves of this engagement. Bill says he wants her blessing. I don't know why he cares. She threatens to file false charges against Bill with his parole officer if he hurts her mother. So, I mean, that's a criminal announcement. You would think that someone who had been arrested as much as Val would know that, but apparently not. And at her place, Kelly gives Abby the rundown on how shitty Bill was when he was married to her mother. And Abby doesn't think you can ever know anyone completely. And she starts to say what Val's father did, but Kelly interrupts to say she knows. I assume all she knows about is that he committed suicide, though. Right?
Well,
because I don't know how else she would know that Val had been sexually abused, because I don't think Brandon even knows that.
You mean Kelly knows that? Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I just assumed that these shitty friends, like, just blabbed about it.
Yeah, could be. So Abby got good at shutting things out, but she doesn't want to shut out Bill. He thinks they have a chance together, and Kelly recommends that Abby look at his history, but Abby confidently says they're getting married on Saturday at something called St. Timothy's. Like, you're getting married in a church this fast? No, you're not. That's not how it works.
No.
But then it's the day of the rehearsal. Val's telling David she's not going. She ends up in a reverie about her father's abuse and tells David about it for what it seems like is the first time. But I thought that he already knew that from when they were dating before.
Yeah.
I seem to remember a black and white flashback or a dream where he's there to protect her.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, we're the only ones who remember.
He explicitly says he doesn't know. So, right. Listeners, if you want to point us to what is probably a season 5 episode where they talk about that, or season 6, we're happy to be, I guess, not corrected.
Yeah, right. So she remembers birthdays in her early teens and how fucked up both her parents were about them. But there was one year that her dad was snowed in Chicago, and her mother made her a chocolate cake with vanilla frosting, which, by the way, is the best cake. And it was her best birthday ever. And so Val does end up showing up for the rehearsal, where Abby immediately shades Val's outfit. Kelly is a bitch about it also. Bill still isn't there, so Kelly goes to see if he called her machine. And Abby is about to yell at Val about her coffee with Bill when he shows up, and Val and Kelly decide they've fought this as long as they can. But turns out Val is better at breaking people up than Kelly, because on the day of the wedding, Bill comes over in casual dad wear, not a suit, because he has cold feet. Now, Kelly is in the position of trying to talk him out of bolting, kind of, but she can't. This is the end of their relationship, she tells him. And even after she says that, he has the balls to ask this, Clip 7.
Just explain it to her.
Sean Donnelly, you're a prince among men.
In my notes, Bill Taylor forever. That is so shitty and awesome.
I just love especially that he's like, and my work here is done, and then just mm-hmm. makes Kelly clean up the mess.
Like, yes. And even after she has said, like, I never want anything to do with you again. Okay, well, just one thing. Tell my fiance I fucked up.
Totally. He's like, is it worth it? Yes, it totally is. Goodbye.
Right. Anyway, Kelly doesn't know how she's supposed to do that when she doesn't understand, but then she fucking does. Abby looks insane. She's upset but trying to be brave, and Val goes after her and tries to stop her, like, pretending this isn't happening, because if people don't know you're hurt, they don't know how to help you, and Abby breaks down with a total cube poo face that you can see in the visual aids at previously.tv. Val comforts her, and then Abby leaves LA that night. Like, she just immediately gets on a plane, like, okay. But Val tells David that she and Abby had a good farewell, which happened off screen, so I guess we have to take her word for it. And she opens the door of his place to a birthday cake like the one her mother made her on her best birthday. Oh, so that erases the bad charm bracelet gift. Good job, David.
Hey, cake is very powerful.
I agree. And as I already said, that's my favorite kind of cake, so I approve. On to the A-plot, let's explore labor issues in media that will surely be solved in the next 20 years, JK.
Sub.
At the beat, Janet is sick and sneezing, but refuses to go home when Brandon tells her to because she won't get sick pay. She apparently also doesn't have health insurance because she jokes about having entered a contest to win coverage, which Brandon the coward does not even acknowledge. Perhaps because he has his own shit, a job interview with The Chronicle. And Steve is betrayed. And just a reminder, was it not just the last episode that Brandon was like recommitting to the beat at that bullshit award thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
And also, I guess the cigarette ad thing is solved.
Right.
Yeah. And they're solvent.
Right.
Okay.
But not so solvent that they can give benefits to their employees.
Mm. Cool.
Anyway. So after the Maya Lee buyer was the superhero one outfit girlfriend from Seinfeld, now Brandon is ushered through the Chronicle office by Two-Face from the Festivus episode of Seinfeld.
Oh my God.
You can see her in the visual aids as well. She gives him an offer and says there's no room for negotiation. He says that working for a big city daily is his dream, which is good because she wants him to start the next day and has a temporary ID for him already. And he's shocked, but goes along with it. So good luck, Steve and Janet, scrambling to put out a paper by yourselves when Steve doesn't know how to do anything. So some other dude whose name is Brian and also just got hired comes in to thank the editor, whose name is Jamie, and she introduces them. And Brian suggests that he and Brandon walk out together, and they're stopped in the hall by a total "Hey, it's that guy" whose name is Michael Cavanaugh. You can see him in the visual aids. You cannot see this on his IMDb, however, because he declined to be credited for this. It is not on the page, and his name is nowhere in, like, the credits on the actual episode.
Oh, my God. I really thought I was losing my mind trying to find the guy, and then I was like, you know what? Who cares? But well, Jesus.
The only reason I was able to find him was because we went to see Midnight Run. It was like a special anniversary screening at the Alamo Drafthouse, like right after I did the notes for this episode. And he, before shows at the Drafthouse, they like put together, you know, collections of like trailers and stuff. And one of them was for this Clint Eastwood movie called The Gauntlet, which he happened to be in. Otherwise, there's no way I would have been able to find him. Like, I put up his picture on Twitter, like, does anyone know who this is? Anyway, Michael Cavanaugh, who was like, nope, when this came up, like, took the check, fucked off. He's wearing a bow tie and carrying a box and tells the boys that his name is Timmy McCourt. Brandon has seen his byline on hundreds of stories and would love to talk to him if he's got a couple of minutes to show them the ropes. And Brandon is just going to be an amazing Metro reporter, what with his excellent powers of observation. Like, he's holding a box. What the fuck do you think that means, you idiot? So Timmy has to tell him he's going to be on the other side of the ropes the next day because the real reporters are going on strike and Brandon and Brian are scabs.
So and then, it's the first that these two newsies have heard of it, even
exactly.
though shit like this is weeks, if not months in the making and is
yep.
totally covered by other newspapers,
yep.
which Brandon should be reading.
Yep.
Dumbass.
If he's a Metro reporter. Yeah. 100%. All of that. So Brandon goes to the beat and catches Steve up in clip 8.
So they're taking these reporters' articles and putting them online?
Right, and they're not paying them anymore for it, and that's their beef.
And Steve is just like, oh, interesting. Like, why is he not angry that Brandon is on his way to another job? Like, what?
Yeah, like, you're not... I don't... I mean, well, there's nothing to say. Like,
no, there isn't.
Thank you for that exposition, Cousin Balky, but I guess... This has nothing to do with you since Brandon literally fucked your only columnist out of a job. So he's basically writing the entire paper, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you're an alt weekly. Do you not have a website?
They might not have that at that time, perhaps.
Maybe.
I mean, they should have, but, you know,
yeah,
a lot of things should at the beat.
They shouldn't be doing multiple cover stories on... the king of Valor, but they are.
No, they shouldn't. Then Steve remembers to be pissed and barks at Janet to pull out the editor resumes that we're supposed to think they have on file. LOL. She asks why the paper wants Brandon to start this soon, and he clears his throat and says the reporters went on strike the night before. Way to be on top of the news in your field, also Janet. But awesomely, Janet interrogates this in clip 9.
Oh, so, you didn't actually get the job. You took someone's. Someone who left on a matter of principle.
When I got the offer, I didn't know they were going to strike.
Well, you know now.
I've waited a long time for a job like this.
And this is how you want to get it?
You know what? No one's starving at the Chronicle. No one's breathing coal dust. This union thing's a thing of the past.
So's this break if I don't take it.
Well, take it.
Don't.
Why is Steve telling him to take it? Again, yeah. I don't know, but thank God.
I love
Janet.
Also that what everyone is basically saying without saying it is that he really should take this job if he wants to be a reporter at a daily because he sucks.
Okay, he's not going to get it any other way. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, editing this shitty paper is not going to count for anything in the long run. Yeah, we know. Anyway, so... Brandon and Brian the next day approach the strikers, comparing notes on how often they've been turned down for jobs at this paper, and Timmy is there with the rest of the strikers, pissed. And Brandon acts like he hasn't made up his mind yet, but Brian says he has kids to feed, and he crosses the picket line, but Timmy glares Brandon into leaving. Good job, Timmy. Speaking of people whose work isn't being valued, Steve and Brandon are dicking around the beat office while Janet deals with an irate advertiser on the phone, finally ending her call and reading them for filth. She's swamped, sick, and underpaid, as we heard up top. And then asks if Brandon isn't supposed to be at his other job, but he tells her he couldn't cross the picket line, and she's glad. And Steve is, predictably, still anti-union and ignorant in clip 10.
I hate to see you walk away from something you want so bad. And for what? A union that won't let you in because its members have a lock on all the jobs.
Not how unions work, by the way. And the most annoying thing about this, like, eventually, you know, they come around to the pro-union side, sort of, but they never really spell out how wrong Steve is about everything he's saying, which is especially infuriating when you consider every person who made this episode is in a union. You know, like, this is really irresponsible. Not that I expect them to be responsible, but still.
Well, yeah. And also that, like, Brandon... Like, what does Brandon even do all day?
Yeah.
Because he's just like, he has plenty of time to, you know, about stupid fucking Jill in between having apparently two jobs as both the editor-in-chief of The Beat and, like, Cron Scab. Like,
right.
All right.
Yeah.
Douche.
It's dumb.
Yeah.
So then Donald, the guy from the Ted sting, shows up. He's there to interview for Brandon's job, and Brandon and Steve like just unceremoniously tell him there is no job, and then we get to see him laugh because that's what he does when he's nervous or disappointed, and he's a big nerd. Let's all laugh at Donald, I guess. Whatever. And then Brian calls from his car to tell Brandon about a housing project that just collapsed, and he's going to feed Brandon the facts to write it up. And Brandon says he didn't take the Chronicle job. Brian doesn't have the time to do the research and write it. This is his first piece, and he needs to work with a good writer. Not sure why he called Brandon. But then Brian hangs up, and Brandon's in a pickle.
Also, what year do they think it is? This is like a scene from The Natural I think it's Airplane, where they all run out of the press conference and into the line of phone booths and it tips over. Like, it's not actually the '50s.
Yeah.
Like, hey, get me a copy. And then there's a little like scoop card in his hat. Like, that's, I know you're on a cell phone, but it's not actually how it works.
Right. And if you have a cell phone, you probably have a laptop. So like, just pull over and write it. I'm just spitballing here. Anyway, Steve drives Brandon to the Chronicle the next day for some more ignorant assholery in clip 11.
You know, if you're freelancing, you could have emailed this in. Worn a disguise. What are they striking for? Ergonomically designed seats? Espresso machine in the break room? What?
Salary, pension, reprinting rights.
What do you think?
I think I'd be happy with what they're getting now.
And how do you think they got what they're getting now? This is why you strike.
Also, it's called dues paying, you sawed-off little fuck stain.
Honest
fuck off. And immediately after this, the Airborne Tomato of Justice.
Yes.
Which you can see in our visual aids. It's huge.
It is.
I think
so
they
big.
Actually use like a balloon partly filled with water, and whoever threw it through a fucking strike, like it bangs him on the shoulder and sprays everywhere. It's so good.
It's gorgeous. So Brandon then turns back to Steve and orders him to tell Donald that the job is open because it's true what all the conservative columnists tweet all the time. When a stranger says something mean and untrue about you, it just forces you to live down to whatever they're saying you are. In other words, Brandon crosses the picket line because fuck his principles, I guess. Now he's been hit by a tomato and he hates labor. I don't know. Anyway, Brandon and Janet are looking at photo proofs when Timmy shows up at the beat. He saw Brandon's byline on the housing story and calls it a good piece. I doubt it. And then he tells a folksy anecdote to get across the point that Brandon shouldn't scab. And then Brandon and his ugly tie decide not to take the Chronicle job and to advocate for better benefits for himself, but really for Janet, which all also happens off screen. So I guess I hope that they did right by her, but we have no way of knowing. Other than that, she doesn't quit, I guess. And then Brandon and Kelly finally meet up at the end of the episode. She sees his Chronicle ID and asks to keep it as a reminder that there's one man in her life who acts right or some shit. I don't know. Who cares? It's the end of the episode.
Oh, my God. Even though his whole like weird career, it's not even an arc.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this bizarre zigzag.
Yeah.
Dave, if you have the Brandon Walsh, what? You, that would be a good time for that one. Yeah, that it's like we're just going in two different directions. It's like Brandon's going in a direction. News to me.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Well, we get more of that next week, but yeah. All right. I guess we're not getting that Brandon cue, so let's do the episode MVP. Timmy, who both was right about unions and refused to put his name on the episode.
The anonymous major league pitcher standing behind Timmy, who launched a tomato at Brandon and managed not to.
Perfect.
Thanks,
least valuable player. Bill Taylor. I hate to say it, but that's pretty shitty.
He was my like number two in the MVP running, actually.
Fair.
Least valuable player. So many to choose from. Brian.
Yeah, Brian the scab. Yep. All right. We have a user submitted challenge.
I scored some amazing stones.
At Dennis Markham asks us to list, and Dave, you can get in on this one too, 5 ways the episode could have been improved if everyone were Wookiees. Their hair would look better. That's one.
If everyone on the picket line is a Wookiee, I really feel like management would cave a lot faster.
Yeah, that's a great point. They'd be a lot more articulate than many of these characters. Donna.
The Donna would have a sash over her cleavern.
Yeah. And,
it would help the newspaper, grab that, very lucrative, Shuri Wook, reading demographic.
Yes.
There you go.
That makes fun.
It is time once again for the excerpt from the sassy piece. Can anyone on 90210 act? We are going to wrap up our coverage of this, unfortunately, since this is often the most enjoyable thing that we get to contemplate in any given episode. But I have good news. Listener Chrissy, who is a librarian, somehow found this Star Reflection series Luke Perry book. And I was going to wait until he returned to the show to start reading excerpts from that. But we only have so many things to cling to. So... stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, let us wrap up with what this acting coach from Sassy thought of the actor's future prospects. Last week, we talked about his thoughts on Gabrielle Carteris and Jenny Garth. And now it's which actors he thinks have a future. If I were making bets, I'd say the two lead guys, Jason and Luke, have the potential of doing a great deal more. They have the ability to project a personality despite the script's limitations. Well, that's true. Most of the other actors are more or less doing what they're told, but these two are able to operate outside the script to flesh it out with some personality. They also manage to project intelligence and sensitivity, the two essential qualities in getting an audience to notice you.
Okay. Not sure I agree 100% with your police work there, Lou, but sure.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely project personality. It's, you know, an unpleasant one. And the final segment, lest you think Richard's being too harsh. Remember, this was an easy game to play, to sit and watch a tape and then make a series of pronouncements. Hey, leave it to the professionals. Yeah. A is good, B isn't. If you are in the business and you have been teaching actors and you know the way shows are made, you know it can't be as simple as that. It is very easy to make a pronouncement on somebody's career or on somebody's talent in 3 seconds, but there is so much that has to be factored in. How much time are they given? How much of a chance is there to draw a performance out? Do the creators want a walk-on performance or something that we would equate with a deeply felt performance? In the case of 90210, I would have to say they're definitely not looking for the latter. all right.
Indeed.
Well, thank you, Richard, for your 25-year-old insights that... I don't totally agree with them, but there was some secret shade there that I really enjoyed. And thank you, Chrissy, for providing the next vine that we can swing to in the tertiary sources department. We are looking forward to it. Next time on Again With This, more like Seymour Harsh, am I right? Brandon and his dumb hockey arena story get zambonied by the bland ambition of a, quote, real journalist. The same admirable rectitude that allowed David to produce Bigot Otter's Jug Band Rally album for like 20 episodes won't permit him to sell deodorant. And your co-hosts are going to find out if it's actually possible to die of boredom. You'll find out if corneal abruptions are fatal when you check out our visual aids for this and every other episode of Again With This. They're on our website at previously.tv. You can follow that website at PreviouslyTV on Twitter, and you can follow this podcast at AWT90210. I am the other airborne tomato of justice, Sarah D. Bunting, and I am on Twitter at, strangely enough, Tomato Nation. My co-host is Donna Karen Truther, Tara Ariano. She's on Twitter at Tara Ariano, and our producer, as always, is Shotgun Editor David T. Cole. We'll talk to you next time.
Hi, you know what to do after the beeparoonie.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.